Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor Martin Roddy. Professor Roddy is Professor of Central European History at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at University College London. He is the author of a good number of well-praised books dealing with, respectively, the Emperor Charles V, and aspects of Magyar history. And today we are speaking about his newest book, The Habsburgs, To Rule the World. Welcome, Professor Roddy.
Greetings.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
Well, the thesis of the book, let's put it another way, because we're dealing with a vast an empire that reached round the world at one point, and we're dealing with 1,000 years of history. So to impose a thesis on such a geographic spread and such a chronological range would be difficult indeed. I think it would be forcing something into a Procrustean bed. What I've tried to show is the dynamics that guided the Habsburg family during the period of their rule globally and over that period of 1,000 years. So in other words, what I've tried to do is to show the dynamics, and the dynamics are firstly a belief in a mission for the family, a dynastic identity, a belief that they have a vocation which is worldwide, which is literally to rule the world, as they themselves put it in the 15th century, that they are there as well to protect the Catholic Church, to forward the faith. And then, of course, as we move into the modern period, that they are there to maintain the happiness, welfare, and indeed bliss of subjects. Then in the 19th century, to act as a bulwark against liberalism and revolutionary nationalism, and finally as an institution that tries to maintain peace in Central Europe. So there are going to be a number of different missions, but all of those are grandiose, and all of them speak to the greatness that they believe is inherent within their family.
Can you explain for the audience the origins of the dynasty?
The we can go back to about the year the 10th century, somewhere at the end of the 10th century, and at that point the Habsburgs are rulers of a package of lands, distributed a broken up package of lands on the French German French border today in Alsace and in northern Switzerland. This is their home base. And the main branch of the Habsburgs are confined to or operating within the region known as the Aargau, which is now in northern Switzerland. Now, the Aargau is a part of Switzerland, and most people imagine that Switzerland consists of mountains. About 40% of Switzerland today is plain, or at least rolling countryside. And this is where the Habsburgs have their origin. Now, if you think they've got the Alps behind them, you're going to have a large amount of rivers flowing through that territory. It's very well watered, and the Habsburgs originate at the confluence of three of the great rivers in northern Switzerland, the Aare, the Reuss, and the Limmat. Their earliest, one of their earliest possessions is a place called Brugge, which means bridge, precisely because it's over the rivers, and Brugge stands more or less at the place of their confluence. And the rivers nourish the plains, they provide a very fertile countryside. They also provide routes for commerce, and beside the rivers are the great roadways that are built, which will cross the Alps. And the big one there is the St. Gotthard Pass, which opens in the 1220s and really provides a link between the cities of northern Italy and the great fairs of northern France and Flanders. So they are straddling a very lush countryside, and they are straddling a great commercial network. So they're able to build up their power during the course of the 12th and 13th centuries. And it's in the 13th century that the real takeoff happens, because a Habsburg is appointed Holy Roman Emperor, i.e., well, at this point, he's just king, King Rudolf, and he's appointed king of Germany. It's an elected office. Nobody else is available. And the princes think, well, we'll have Rudolf because he's already well into his 50s. He won't last much longer. In fact, he goes on for another 20 years. And during that time, he takes on the greatest lord in Central Europe, who is Ottokar II of Bohemia. And he defeats Ottokar, kills him on the battlefield, and takes his Austrian lands, so that they have got on the one side these Swiss lands, and then on the other side these Austrian lands. And the Austrian lands themselves are also wealthy. They have a considerable metal industry. They have towns that feed in through the Adriatic trade. These are, again, wealthy places. Ideally, the Habsburgs would like to get their hands on Bohemia, which has a tremendous mining industry. But they will have to wait till the 16th century. But that is the origin of Habsburg power. It's based on commerce, and it's based on the seizure of the Austrian lands in 1278.
What explains the relative eclipse of the dynasty in the 14th century?
The 14th century is unfortunate for the Habsburgs. They've made it to the office of King of Germany. In order to become emperor, you have to be crowned in Rome. At this time, they aren't crowned in Rome. They plan to, but it's quite a journey. They are able to, Rudolf is able to get his son eventually appointed as his successor. The electors are very reluctant to have a father-to-son succession, so there's an intermediate stage. They don't want a hereditary dynasty appearing, but Albrecht, Rudolf's son, does manage to take over, but he is assassinated by a nephew in 1308. And this casts a pall over the family. It's a great disgrace that there has been what is called at the time a parricide within the family. And that pushes the Habsburgs to the margins. And instead, we see new families emerging, particularly the Wittelsbachs in Bavaria and the Luxemburgers, who will move, rather like the Habsburgs move from Switzerland to Austria, the Luxemburgers will move from Luxembourg, to take over Bohemia. And they will, though these two, the Wittelsbachs and Luxemburgers, will be the dominant families in the 14th century. And it's only when the Luxemburg line expires that the Habsburgs are back in with a chance.
How exactly did Frederick III become emperor in the mid-15th century?
It's a complex development. The Sigismund of Luxembourg, who is the last of the Luxembourg rulers, he has married his daughter to Albert of Habsburg. Albert of Habsburg is a particularly good military commander, and Sigismund needs Albert to provide the expertise, but also the resource and wherewithal to help him in his wars in Bohemia, where he's fighting a mixture, really, of a national rebellion and a religious rebellion. He needs Albert of Habsburg. And so Albert marries the daughter of Sigismund, and when Sigismund dies, the electors go along, if you like, with Sigismund's promotion and preferment of this man, and they elect him as king. The problem is that Albert succumbs almost immediately to dysentery. The electors then look around, and the leader of the Habsburg family is Frederick the Third, and they elect him because he stands closest to Albert, and at the same time he has all the right credentials. He's very tall, he is distinguished looking, with long blonde hair. He's of originally Polish origin, and long blonde hair is one of the marks of the Polish kings, and he has done all the right things. He's been to Jerusalem. He was dubbed a knight there. And the electors choose him. And, of course, the great thing about him is that he remains on the throne for something like 50 years. By the time he dies in the 1490s, a Habsburg has been running the Holy Roman Emperor as either a king or as an emperor, like Frederick III. They've been running it for 50, 60 years. And that consolidates the Habsburg position. It now becomes almost de facto that there is going to be a Habsburg running it. And Frederick is able to get his son Maximilian crowned in advance. So Maximilian succeeds Frederick and continues the Habsburg line, which will then remain more or less unbroken until the dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire in 1806.
What does one make of the Emperor Maximilian? He seems to have embodied in some ways aspects of Habsburg ideals. At the same time, in terms of concrete achievements, seems to be lacking.
Well, I mean, he wouldn't agree with you, because the place he originally intended to be his tomb, but it wouldn't fit and had to be moved elsewhere. His empty tomb, therefore, consists of 17 panels where he lists his military victories. I think that the key with Maximilian is, firstly, the marriage that he constructs in 1478 with Mary of Burgundy. And this brings him the bride who is the wealthiest woman in Christendom at the time. She is the heir to the Burgundian fortune, which includes critically the Low Countries, which are the economic powerhouse of Europe. So he's got tremendous wealth through his wife, but that's in name only. He's going to have to fight for it. And for very long periods, he's at war in the Netherlands, in Belgium and the Netherlands, in the Low Countries. He's at war trying to make sure that the cities and the local nobility will accept his rule. It takes virtually his entire career to establish that. So there is an achievement there. He's also active in northern Italy less effectively. He's trying to outmaneuver the French king. Ultimately, it will be his grandson that does that outmaneuvering, and the reckoning will be delayed until the 1520s. But Maximilian himself is a doer as well as a dreamer. He's remembered as a dreamer because he has all these splendid commissions with artists like Albrecht Dürer, and they put together huge woodcuts. And the purpose of these woodcuts, and what we're talking about, one woodcut I think is something like 100 feet long, another is 14 foot high, representing either a triumphal procession or what is known as the triumphal arch, which is an allegory of Maximilian's achievements. And these, the idea is that these will be given to noblemen to put up in their castles, and to town councils to put into their town halls, that you'll receive a gift of 40, 80 sheets of paper. You may choose to colour them in if you want to, and then you'll glue them up as a statement of Maximilian's greatness, a present from Maximilian about himself, really. But on top of that, we've got 2,000 portraits of Maximilian. He's always having his portrait taken, and the reason is to make sure that people know who he is. He's a will send these portraits out to people so they can know and see and have a visible reminder of who the emperor actually is. And when he's not sending people allegories of himself and of the Habsburgs or portraits of himself, he's visiting them. He probably is the most traveled of the emperors for about 100 years. He goes throughout Germany, northern Italy. He is there in order to make his presence known. So, yes, Maximilian has fabulous ideas about what the Habsburgs stand for. But at the same time, he's not just somebody who loftily ruminates. He's somebody who gets on with the task of governing, and he understands how the dynastic system works. And of course, what we have most spectacularly is the twin double marriages he arranges, whereby he marries his son to a Spanish princess, and a Spanish prince will then marry a second of his daughters, another of his daughters, and then we have the similar double marriage being engineered with the rulers of Bohemia, or the ruler of Bohemia and Hungary. Now, these dynastic marriages are gambles, because depending on who dies first, the spoils may go to either side of the contracting parties. Maximilian's gamble pays off twice, so that he is able to get his son as King of Spain. He is Philip I of Spain, and he's able to get his grandson Ferdinand as King of Bohemia and Hungary in 1526 after his death. But the plan has been put in train in advance by Maximilian.
How influenced was the Emperor Maximilian and his grandson Charles V by the court style and richness of the Valois Dukes of Burgundy?
There is an emulation there. They don't have the money that the Valois Dukes have, because Burgundy itself has been lost. And Burgundy, it's been taken over by France, leaving really this rump in the Holy Roman Empire, Franche-Comté, but also the Low Countries. They pick up, however, the much of the, firstly, the formality of the Burgundian court. And it's very formal, and as a result, retraining has to take place of their of Charles V's household to get it to conform to Burgundian standards. And particularly as well, they take over the Order of the Golden Fleece. This is the most prestigious of the chivalric orders, and it's a mechanism whereby Charles V in particular is able to reward loyal brokerage system, whereby the ruler is able to listen, take on board, and consider complaints given at meetings of the order, given in a company almost of equals. So the Burgundian ceremony is adopted, Burgundian forms are adopted, but they are utilized in a way to bring about political purposes.
Would it be true to say that you do not agree with those German 19th century historians who argued that it was the Habsburgs' extra German interests and concerns that prevented them from making Germany, or the Holy Roman Empire for that matter, a nation state a la England and France?
I mean, this is one of the huge problems in dealing with the Habsburgs, is that it's overwritten by 19th and 20th century historiography. And the concern that historians had in the 19th century was the administrative centralization. They believe in the state. They see centralized institutions as necessary for state formation. And of course, the Habsburgs never have a centralized administration. They have separate administrations for their separate lands. They don't adopt, if you like, a high modern position. At the same time, they have a multinational state. They don't just confine themselves to Germany, because people aren't really thinking in terms. They may think in terms of nationhood, but they're not making that necessary connection between state and nationhood, which is assumed in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So the problem with dealing with the Habsburgs is that one's applying to them categories that really just don't fit at all for the time in which they're operating. And German historians, of course, they look at the Habsburgs and they blame them to an extent, and particularly Prussian ones, because they don't like the fact that they're Catholics. But German historians are constantly in the business of blaming, particularly 19th and 20th century ones, blaming Frederick II in the 13th century for spending more time in Italy and Sicily than he did in Germany, blaming the investiture contest in the 11th and early 12th centuries for disrupting the power of the monarchy and forcing humiliations on poor Emperor Henry IV. So, in other words, there's a long tradition there of German historians looking for an explanation as to why a unified German state only emerged in the 1870s. And they're really asking the wrong question, because it's not just Germany that's a late developer. So is most of Europe, actually. Italy is only unified in the 1860s. Then Hungary, Bohemia, these only become independent nation states much later. So in other words, they're really asking, firstly, the wrong question, and they're not looking over their shoulders at what's happening elsewhere.
How would you evaluate the successes and failures of Charles V? And would it not be the case that you look upon him not quite in the same light in terms of success as Geoffrey Parker in his recent biography?
Well, I mean, I think the point that Parker makes is that he does his best with the resources available to him, and that, of course, is the critical point that his he has the Netherlands, he has Spain, but he's fighting on a German front. And he is at times fighting on a Mediterranean front as well. And he's also having to sustain wars in northern Italy. He's got an awful lot of resource intensive obligations to meet. The main problem which he has is that he can't conceive of a religious solution that falls short of admitting the supremacy of the Pope. And admitting basic tenets of Catholic doctrine. If he had been able to be flexible on that, and this is what Protestants say, just give us a bit of flexibility and we can do a deal. He can't, he isn't flexible enough, and at the same time, he's a person that wants everything pinned down. His brother is much more subtle, much more ready to leave things open. And that, I think, is where Charles V comes unstuck. It's his problem really with Germany that is his undoing, and how he evaluates himself as well. He regards himself as having failed, and he regards that failure as really having been played out on the German stage.
Would you agree with Fernand Braudel that there was a missed opportunity when Philip II did not take Cardinal Granvelle's advice and move the capital of his empire from Madrid to Lisbon?
That's too speculative. I couldn't possibly answer that. I mean, that's... I mean, there are going to be plenty of missed opportunities, and that strikes me as one of the most remote. What's more, the point is the missed opportunity of not actually getting a settlement with England. That would have been the cleverer thing to have done.
Was it not the case that the future Emperor Rudolf II and his brothers were educated at the Spanish court because their uncle Philip II distrusted the orthodoxy of his cousin and brother-in-law, the Emperor Maximilian II?
I think it's more than that, because I mean Maximilian II himself is brought up in Spain, and it's part of the, if you like, coming of age that rulers should spend time in their cousins' courts. So Philip II does spend time. He spends time in the Netherlands. He spends time in Germany. He attends some of the sessions of the Council of Trent. And he's not very good. Philip II is a very stiff man, and he doesn't really like the way that German politics is largely about drinking with German princes until you're under the table. And he's not very good at that. So in other words, there is plenty of this idea of transfer of young men from one court to another, because they still see the Habsburg empire, even though it's been divided on Charles V's death into, if you like, the two branches. One headed by Charles's brother Ferdinand, the other headed by his son Philip. Despite these two branches emerging, they consider themselves to be all still part and parcel of the House of Austria. So, in other words, that exchange of persons is part of the Habsburg idea. And so, likewise, is the intermarriage. They're regularly marrying into the other branch, exchanging, if you like, cousins, nephews, and nieces. Each one of those is technically an incestuous union. Each one of them has to get permission from the Pope. And of course, over time, one will see the products of what happens with repeated intermarriage between members of the same family.
was not one of the most important results of the Battle of the White Mountain, the Germanization of the Bohemian nobility?
That's a difficult one. The Bohemian nobility, about a third to a half, depending on how you count them, are eliminated. They're forced into exile. They are replaced by people that have been loyal to Ferdinand II. So that would be Germans, and that would be Italians as well. There are plenty of Italians will go into Bohemia and hold office and hold aristocratic titles there. It's this idea of Germanization that I find a little bit difficult, because there are plenty of Czech nobles who make a deal with the Habsburgs, and they retain their Czechishness. It's just that they happen to speak German. That is the language of the court, and they speak Italian because that's also one of the languages of the court at various points. So the extent to which they're Germanized, I think, is a difficult one to tease out. They have been homogenized within the general Habsburg idea, which is about regular trips to Vienna, having a palace in Vienna as well as a palace in the Bohemian countryside. So they're being more homogenized as an imperial aristocracy rather than being Germanized into an alien German aristocracy.
How did the Emperor Leopold reassert Habsburg power in the empire after the disaster of the 30 Years' War?
Well, he assumes leadership of the German princes because they are universally threatened by Louis XIV, and he is able to lead the German princes to put together a resistance to Louis XIV and enlist various commanders that will assist him in that process. He's also, most importantly, he defeats the Ottoman Turks. The Ottoman Turks have been a threat on the southern part of Europe for several centuries, and it's Leopold who gets rid of them. That has three main consequences. The first is that he's able to show himself as a martial hero. In fact, he spends most of the time in Vienna. He doesn't lead any troops, but he's able to present himself as a new Hercules, a new Samson, who has destroyed the Turkish lion. That's the first point. The second point is that he's able to in 1683 the Turks are in Vienna or outside Vienna, and they are raiding Bavaria. So one of the critical points is he has given security to the empire, given security to the southern flank, which was at risk of being hit by the Turks. And thirdly, he has removed an ally of Louis XIV. Louis XIV is constantly trying to use the Turks and the Hungarians in order to embarrass Leopold, in order to score points, to score an advantage in his rear, as it were, in the rear, Leopold's rear, so that he's never able to concentrate forces on Louis XIV. And the Turks, the removal of the Turks, removes that difficulty and that danger. So the importance of of Leopold's leadership cannot be underestimated, even though he's a pretty unprepossessing character. He's not really a very pleasant man, and at the same time, he spends huge amounts of time delaying, and diplomatically, he's normally a bit of a disaster.
Why do you portray the Queen Empress, Maria Theresa, as being much less an institutional conservative than is commonly the case?
Much less an institutional conservative. Yeah, because she wasn't. I mean, she's got a real problem on her hands that she has taken over an empire under the most appalling circumstances. She's not been prepared for government. She doesn't understand how it works. She doesn't have much in the way of advisors that she knows and can trust. And she is confronted by Frederick the Great, who seizes the industrial heartland of the Habsburg monarchy, which is Silesia, which is where the big mining and textile industries are developing. So she has got to do something to get that, to get the monarchy going. And I think that expresses itself in her interest in coordination. And we have this attempt to merge the administrations of Austria and Bohemia, not just the civil service, the entire treasury apparatus. She wants to try and merge those together to provide centralization. She has to put finance outside administration. In the end, it's too unwieldy. She does her best to try and cut down the vast number of sort of subcommittees, what are known as dicasteria, these subcommittees that involve and get in the way of policy making. She institutes a central council that is supposed to survey policy making in the round, have an overall brief to look at pan-monarchical concerns, pan-imperial concerns. She's engaged in a lot. At the same time, she wants to go further. She wants to break down, in particular, the existing set of relationships on the land, particularly feudalism, if you like, or serfdom. And she puts forward great proposals for Hungary. The Hungarian Diet Parliament turns them down. She closes down the parliament and imposes them anyway. So she is an innovator. She has a real problem on her hands, which she's responding to. And at the same time, she's quite inventive in what she does and quite determined in doing it.
How would you differentiate the reform policies of the Emperor Joseph II from those of his mother?
I wouldn't. They are following in largely the same pattern. They are both concerned with, on the one hand, trying to maintain some form of alliance system with France, and on the other, some type of modus vivendi with Prussia. Joseph attempts to bring Russia much more into the equation. The main problem which Joseph has, which Maria wouldn't have got involved in, is this futile war against the Turks, which is what really puts a blight on Joseph's last years. He goes into a war with the Turks as part and parcel of a Russian alliance, and that is too high a price to pay.
Would it be true to say that throughout the book you endeavored to get away from the stereotype that the Habsburgs as rulers and Vienna as an imperial capital were solely interested, culturally speaking, in music and puppet theater, particularly in the 18th century?
Music and puppet theater.
Puppet theater in the 18th century, early 19th century. That you're endeavoring to get away from the stereotype throughout the book.
Well, that's only a small part of the book, so I don't see how it could be throughout. But Yeah, I mean, it's what I'm in. I mean, obviously, it's a center of opera, of theatrical entertainment. I mean, Leopold I is very active with promoting the monarchy through ballet in particular and interludes. And likewise, Joseph II encourages operatic performances. Maria herself is at the opera whenever a new production is put on. So they're very interested and concerned with that. I suppose what I'm more interested in is architecture and art and what it says in terms of the Habsburg vision of themselves, rather than what composers and musicians will be writing, because they have a quite different agenda.
Would it be true to say that, unlike, say, Wolfram Seemann, you do not really take seriously Prince Metternich's ideological discourse of conservatism and legitimacy?
Oh, dear. Yeah, I mean, he's a conservative and he's a legitimist, but, I mean, at the same time, he's prepared to trim both of those in terms of his recognition, for instance, of the Latin American independence. He's prepared to make concessions to that, even though it would offend the legitimist principle and the conservative principle. So, yes, I mean, but at the same time, when it satisfies him, then he will promote these interests through the Congress system. And of course, the Congress system is there to, and gets itself all in a mess because it ends up defending the Ottoman Turks against very popular Greek revolutionaries. So he's prepared to promote certain things, but only when it suits him. When it doesn't suit him, he's prepared to let them go. And certainly he's no stickler for conservatism and for treaties and for legitimate instruments. I mean, the occupation of Krakow, 1846, is a clear violation of the terms of the Treaty of Vienna. So, but it suits him in 1846 to go in and occupy, Krakow.
What explains the quickness of the collapse of the Metternichian regime in March 1848?
Because the court has been plotting against Metternich. And the court is divided. There's not much leadership coming from the top. Emperor Ferdinand I of Austria is not really interested in government at all. He's not providing leadership. Archduchess Sophie is probably the most important person within the court. She doesn't like Metternich. She thinks he's been holding on too long. She wants to promote new people to positions of influence, in particular her son Franz Joseph. And she is pushing, therefore, for change. Behind all this is the malign influence of Anton Kolowrat Liebsteinsky, who thinks he knows far better than Metternich and should be in the driving seat. And that nexus really of Count Kolowrat and Sophie, they are waiting for any occasion in order to get rid of Metternich. They know that on March the 13th, I think it is, 1848, that there's going to be a demonstration. They know there's going to be trouble. They have already brought celebratory bouquets to commemorate Metternich's overthrow. They're waiting for it. And they push. The events take place. They push from within the court. Basically, the chief advisors, people like Albrecht, they come round, and John, they come round to recognizing that if order is going to be maintained, then Metternich should go. The problem is they get rid of Metternich, and that just makes it worse, because people see weakness at the top. It's the classic thing. Do you get rid of the person with whom your regime is associated in order to buy time, or do you stick with them because otherwise it'll look as if you're capitulating and new demands will be laid? They go for getting rid of the man and new demands are laid. And the Habsburg Empire really suffers its greatest shock, a shock far greater than 1740. They suffer a shock because it looks for a time as if they're only going to be left, and if they're lucky, with Hungary.
What explains then the relatively quick collapse of the revolutionary forces?
They're outmaneuvered, and they're outmaneuvered militarily. They are forced into taking a military position. The military position is untenable. You have some very good generals. Once Italy is cleared, the armies can be brought back into coordinated action against the rebellious forces. So you've got a clear movement that Italy, once Italy is clear, then Bohemia falls, and it's almost deliberately engineered a crisis in Bohemia, a crisis in Prague. Then they move against Hungary, and Hungary is defeated in 1849. Vienna is a hotbed of insurrection, and the city is simply bombarded into surrender. So it's the generals are able to bring up their forces and to force a submission of the rebel position.
You state that the absolutist regime of the 1850s was, quote, a Josephist fantasy come true, unquote. But given the Concordat of 1855, isn't this a little bit of an exaggeration?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. The that, of course, is the other side of it. Joseph would not have made such a reconciliation and basically give up huge amounts of the prerogatives that the ruler had in respect of the Catholic Church. But I think one, by over concentrating on the religious side, one loses the dynamism that is going on within Vienna, within the civil service there, as these people who had to put up with a fairly somnambulant regime, they are suddenly released from these from this fairly dull mindset and are able to get on with creating a modernized state structure. So one shouldn't let the Concordat over influence perceptions.
Alan Skidd, in his highly laudatory review of your book in the TLS back, I think, in June of this year, his only query was pertaining to your coverage of the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He's stating that you are too anti-Serbian. What do you make of that criticism?
Well, the chapter on this actually identifies very clearly what the main Serbian problems and difficulties were. And in fact, the harsh regime, which they suffered in Bosnia, I mean, they are excluded from political influence, they're excluded from education, they are excluded from the commercial life, and they operate really at the lowest level of status within Bosnia. They're lower than the Muslims. And on top of that, you've got these largely Croatian archaeologists coming along with all the sorts of cranial and skull evidence to show that Serbs occupy an inferior position in the scale of human development. I identify all that. What I home in on is the culpability of the Serbian government for the assassination. Now, one can go round and round and round arguing about this, but it strikes me that, you know, the evidence of the trial records is fairly firm that the Serbian government was implicated in that. And that would be the point of difference that I have with Alan Sked, who relies very much on a book that came out a couple of years ago, which is not without its problems.
You mean the Zamatica book?
Yeah, Zamatica, yeah, or Zametica.
What explains the reversal of a traditional pro-Austrian, pro-Habsburg view of the empire by British journalists and commentators in the pre-1914 period? I'm thinking of people like Seton Watson, Wickham Steed, who, of course, became very influential during the Great War itself. What explains their reversal of that sort of traditional British pro-Habsburg point of view?
There was a slight intermission there. Wickham Steed is very unfavourable to the Habsburg monarchy, and he sticks his neck out there. The majority of people are regarding Austria as a European necessity. His concern is that he sees the weakness of Austria and thinks that it's highly bureaucratic regime. I love the point which Wickham Steed makes, you know, that it requires, in order to found a hospital, you now require 15 pieces of paper. Well, I hate to think how many thousands of pieces of paper you'd need to have nowadays, but he sees it as an atrophied bureaucracy. He sees its weakness as a threat to the balance of power. So that is Wickham Steed's starting point. Seton Watson's is quite different. Seton Watson discovers that the Hungarians have been lying to him, and he never forgives them for that. And it's that take that he has, that they are oppressing their national minorities. And this is what he writes mostly about, is conditions in Hungary, conditions in Croatia, that it's that that has been that motivates him to write very nasty things about the Hungarian government in particular, and what he sees as Austrian weakness. He believes that Hungary will again, like Wickham Steed, will contribute to the destabilization of the monarchy, and therefore to the destabilization of Europe.
What explains the collapse of the empire so suddenly in November 1918, and why did not the dynasty endeavor to hold on to the rural areas of Upper and Lower Austria?
Because they've lost the rural areas of Upper and Lower Austria. I mean, large chunks of the countryside have been lost to what are known as the Green Cadres. These are bands of deserters, people who have avoided conscription, who've gone into the woods, and they are attacking convoys, post offices. Essentially, huge areas of the countryside have been lost to control. In the countryside as well, there is a complete breakdown of authority as local village mayors seize goods that are going to be taken off to the towns. They make sure that they stay in the localities. So you've got a complete breakdown of law and order in the countryside. It'll be a couple of years before that order is returned. So I don't think they could have gone, you know, into the countryside and made a stand there. The collapse is the same reason that the that Russia collapses in 1917, Germany collapses in 1918, the Ottoman Empire will finally dissolve, depending on how you judge the dissolution in the early 1920s. It's they cannot withstand the privations of war. And one has to remember as well that it's not just the losers that are territorially reconfigured as a result of the First World War. Britain as well faces probably one of the most significant nationalist insurrections in Europe during the First World War. That's namely the Irish uprising. And at the end of the war, has to make concessions to Ireland and get and basically create a separate independent Irish state. So the First World War is having a transforming effect, not only on the losers, but on the victors as well.
What do you make of the sort of nostalgia for the Habsburg monarchy in its late 19th century, early 20th century form that's been taking place in the last, say, 40, 50 years?
Well, it's well done, the Vienna Tourist Board. They've created, a huge number of... they've promoted this nostalgia. It's been encouraged as well by things like Karl Schorska's book on Fantasy Ekla, Vienna, where he made people aware of just what a ferment of ideas was going on there. It's also being encouraged of late by looking at Austrian science, in particular Austrian mathematics, physics, and logic, and there's been a recent book published on that. And so people are becoming more aware of the cultural achievement, but at the same time, there are stories that can be woven. And the story that is woven is the story of Sissi, the Empress Elizabeth, and everything that went on in her life. I mean, she's a great person to very complicated and complex personality. And people are able to home in on that either to show that, you know, here we have a very gifted person, or here we have a woman betrayed. And so it fits various aspirations, but you've got Vienna is promoting it. When I was in Innsbruck last year, I noticed that there's new sort of emphasis on the Empress there. In Budapest, they've got Sissi trails for tourist purposes. An awful lot is to do with promoting tourist destinations. And, of course, it's been helped by the fact that Hungary and Czech Republic have been in receipt of a huge amount of European funding for heritage, and they have been able to restore and really make their heritage buildings, make them really look sparkling. So I think there's a number of factors that come in and coincide there. There's an academic interest in aspects of Vienna. There's a tourist interest, and there's some personalities around which a story can be woven.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
The Habsburgs need to be taken seriously.
Well, with that observation, which I agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Roddy, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Roddy.
Thank you.